I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Autism is the most commonly diagnosed childhood disorder in the United States. The Center for Disease Control estimates that one in every 88 children has autism. It typically appears in the first 3 years of life and affects the brain, impacting social and communication skills, and often causes sensory problems. Joining us today to talk about what we know and don't know about autism, along with how it's diagnosed and treated, is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
And a couple minutes, psychologist Michael Abbruzzese will also join us. You know, I look back on some of the notes I had from a previous program we did on this in 2010, where estimates were one in 110 children from the CDC, and now they're saying one in 88. So these numbers are increasing all the time. It's so quickly. Obviously, we know there's a genetic component, but genetics alone and even better diagnosis doesn't speak to these rising numbers as quickly.
No, and actually, if you look back even further, you know, this syndrome got its name in the 40s, 1940s. So it's a relatively new diagnosis, if you will. It's interesting to know whether in the 1800s, in the 1700s, in the 1500s, autistic kids. We don't know. They were probably, if there were, they were probably grouped with people that were mentally retarded in some way and treated as such. However, in the 1960s, a study, the numbers was 4.5 kids out of 10,000 had the condition or met the criteria. Now you're talking about the jump to 100, what would you say, 130?
One in every 88.
Now it's one in 88. So it's been jumping. And of course, we want to know why.
Right. And so there's lots of theories, and you know, there's got to be some kind of environmental factor at play here, or factors, or, you know, multiple things. We just don't know at this point.
We just don't know. And there is genetic component. There's no doubt about that. But it's very complex, and there's no such thing as one autism gene or two autism genes. As a matter of fact, when they look at the DNA, which has been parts of the DNA have been linked to autism, because the DNA is what gives the nerve cells directions of how to connect and how to form themselves, et cetera. And that's where the deficit is in neurologically in autism. There are about 1,000 different coding areas that have been linked to the disorder.
Wow.
And each one, even the ones that are most frequently pop up as being associated with autism, only have less than 1% of contribution to the disorder.
Wow.
So that means that it means what we say, that every case is really unique.
Very different.
Very different. And it's a complex combination, at least from the genetic point of view, of contributors.
Right. And of course, that also talks to the severity of this we call autism spectrum disorder. So tell us, what is autism and what is this autism spectrum disorder?
Well, the original diagnosis was made in the 1940s, and it was around children that showed some kind of social and communication problems. And it's not surprising when you think about it that much of the human brain is devoted to social functioning. Social functioning is one of the more recent additions to evolution of life. And there's a lot of real estate, if you want, in the human brain that has to do with social interactions and language, because those two things are what makes humans the top of the food chain. It's really why we've been successful. So it's not surprising then that something could go wrong in developing this complex network of systems. And that's indeed what autism is. It's simply a miswiring of networks that have to do with communication and social interaction. And because the networks are complex, the disorder is complex.
Right. So we have varying degrees. We see some kids who are severely autistic, really don't communicate at all, and others who may have some social miscues, but seem to be able to you know, function.
That's right. And I'm looking back on my practice over the years, I'm sure I've missed people that were really autistic, or probably Asperger's type disorder, because I was treating them for their psychiatric condition, like depression, anxiety, which frequently goes along with it. But you just don't know sometimes.
Right.
You don't want to label somebody when they're not, don't deserve the label. And then then we'll talk about it more, but you get into all the problems of the fallout from the label. Mm-hmm,
exactly, yeah. Talk about that. You said Asperger's, and how are they connected? We've got, you know, what is Asperger's considered?
I mean, Asperger's is, first off, there has to be social communication problems and language problems. There can be just social and communication problems without the large portion of the language troubles. And without what's called repetitive behaviors, or with very little repetitive behaviors, which also is a feature of autistic disorders. So when somebody is just impaired socially and has shows restrictive or repetitive behaviors in the form of restrictive interests, then we call them Asperger's disorder. That's what is the diagnosis of Asperger's disorder. And these kids... adults can be very functional in very in various areas, but they're limited and they're socially awkward.
Gotcha. All right. So in recent years, we've had a lot of progress in early diagnosis. So how early can this be detected and how?
Yeah. Well, first off, it's a disorder that does appear early in childhood. And probably you might have some clues when the baby is first born because they might have some other neurological-like signs that don't necessarily track to autism, but they could, like poor muscle tone. So that might be on day one or day two or the first week of life. But really, after about 6 months, you can start to see signs of some social connectiveness problems. There's screening that is done that really recalls – that calls for or mandates further investigation. And that consists of if the child isn't babbling by 12 months, or if the child isn't gesturing or pointing to things by 1 year, by 12 months. And then by 16 months, if they're not uttering single words, and by 2 years, if they're not uttering two words together that are meaningful. Those are signs that you're maybe dealing with more than just a little bit of a delay of capacities, and you need to look at things further. So we're talking about the first 3 years of life, certainly, that is critical for the signs to appear and the diagnosis to be made. If the signs appear, say, at a kid 10 years of age, it probably isn't autism. This is really a neurodevelopmental disorder, meaning it's the development of the nervous system over time that is a problem. When we're born, we're not born with a full brain connected. It happens over years, the first few years of life. And this is a disorder that happens probably in utero, begins in utero, where when the brain is first being formed, and then becomes manifested as more demands from the environment are made, which happen after birth and, say, from 6 months on.
And really, it's amazing what we have in place now to try to help with that early diagnosis. And remember years ago, they used to be, what did they call it? It was the mom's fault. What do they call that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. Refrigerator mother.
Yeah.
When I trained in psychiatry, that was the theory.
That was not a nurturing mother. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a religion. It was the mother's fault. Yeah. And unfortunately, that has stayed on, at least the idea or the feeling about it has stayed on. And that's a challenge that the parents have to overcome.
Because it's not the mother's fault, of course.
Absolutely not.
Not her fault. But,
Nor is it completely the mother's fault in terms of if you just look at the genes, the gene story, or the father's fault.
Yeah.
It's
so complicated, as you're saying.
Very, very complicated.
And again, we don't at this point know what those environmental factors are that are contributing to all this. So certainly there's a lot going on here. But with the early diagnosis now, as you're saying, there's certain trigger points. And as you are bringing your baby in to see the doctor, they're looking for some of these things now where they, in years past, didn't. I mean, this is relatively new where they're looking for these signs.
Absolutely right. That's the job of the pediatrician and really paying close attention here.
Now, you mentioned sometimes there are other developmental or neurological diagnoses along with autism. What are some of the things that you see commonly with children who have autism?
Yeah, autism occurs along with a number of things, and sometimes the other things can be the prominent things, and the autistic aspect is less prominent, but still there. Attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity disorder, is one of the very common things. Obsessive compulsive disorder is another common psychiatric condition. Intellectual impairment, what we used to call mental retardation, is another thing that goes along with it. And then there it can be all sorts of other nervous system disorders that are more rare, but can be associated with autism. So seizures, for instance, is one of them.
What about this connection between digestive disorders and autistic symptoms?
I don't know.
You don't know about that. I was going to say, because that seems to be, you know, you hear that a lot of moms who have kids with autism, they talk about their children having digestive issues.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me, because there's one thing that we do know biologically, and that comes from embryology. When they're right after fertilization and the cells start forming after a few weeks, or maybe even 2 or 3 weeks, there's a three layers of cells, ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm, from which everything else comes. Well, it turns out that the nervous system and the gut come from the same layer, the ectoderm. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's a strong link between diet and what happens in the nervous system.
And psychologist Michael Abruzzese joins us now. Good morning.
This reinforces what Dr. Will has been talking about, is how difficult it is to come up with an accurate diagnosis, and I'm really glad that they have called it in the new DSM autistic spectrum. I think a lot of clinicians, as well as myself, have been calling it autistic spectrum. We also refer now to ADHD spectrum. There's such a wide rainbow of nuances, and it makes it very difficult to determine. And I think the difference between what sometimes are classified as neurotypicals and atypicals is sometimes such a degree of diagnostic experience that I've seen the development of autistic or Asperger clinics, or we go there. Everyone who goes in neurotypical, comes out Asperger's, they come out autism. So I think there has to be some skepticism, because it's such a clinical diagnosis. You know, we talked, Mark and I have talked about how it's a clinical diagnosis for ADHD.
That's right.
And most of the psychological and psychiatric syndromes are clinical diagnoses. There's no test you can give. And the diagnosis really for autism, the autism spectrum conditions, are third-party reporters.
Yes.
You know, someone says, well, what's it like when so-and-so does such-and-such? Are they such-and-such? And yes, no.
Yes.
And it's really an unreliable kind of diagnostic category, because there's no verifiability and no inter-rater reliability. So it's a very shadowy area still.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, and this, I guess, goes back to that whole thing of how complicated, and each case being so unique, that even makes it more frustrating
Absolutely.
For the parents who are trying to find out what's the best treatment for my child.
True.
That's right.
True. I want to go back to what Mark said about the gastrointestinal. You had raised it, Mindy. It's true that some physicians still consider the gut to be like the second cardiovascular system. So I'm sure we have not even investigated as much of gastrointestinal connections to neurological symptoms as perhaps we might in the future. And some astute observer and researcher who get a lot of money might want to do that. I think that would be very fruitful.
Even sort of anecdotally, and we've had parents who've told us, you know, once they've found this, you know, particular diet that's really relieved some of their child's symptoms. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to collect all that information and, as you said, do some research on that.
If you consider autism to be a problem with connections in the brain, the brain and the gut are intimately related. The gut produces a lot of feedback back to the brain via the vagus nerve that can become scrambled in its interpretation. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
So that if you have somebody on a diet where that doesn't, say, irritate the gut in some way, that is decreasing their sensitivity that comes back. It's just like the kid who can't stand certain kind of clothes, wool, say. Their skin is just too sensitive to it. Think of that as that's what happens in the gut. The gut is too sensitive to whatever is being, to the McDonald's hamburger or something, as opposed to.
And again, it's very,
more refined.
it varies and is individualized. There's not really a group category. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of times the diagnosis really involves looking for outliers, mm-hmm. not a group inclusion.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about autism with psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Our toll-free number, if you would like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. We were talking about how it's diagnosed and how complicated that is. What about treatment? That's got to be just as complicated, I would assume. And do symptoms improve over time?
Well, like most things, some symptoms improve. Some symptoms just go underground and they morph into something else. And other symptoms, people have just developed either coping skills that they've learned from an external source, or they figured out themselves how to overcome some symptoms. So there's at least a triumvirate of how symptoms change. So mm-hmm. it's impossible to say whether they just go away, whether we age out of them, or whether we just get used to them and we cope with them. Also, if you go into a different environment, different symptomatology may pop up mm-hmm. because we have different stressors involved in that.
In general, though, there's a trend toward improvement over the years into later adolescence and then adulthood, especially the repetitive behaviors mm-hmm. tend to improve.
Right. And I think it's important, what Dr. Whaley just mentioned, it's important to talk about the nuances. I was referring mostly to people in the Asperger syndrome, mm-hmm. and I think he was talking more
that's right.
to people in the more deeply involved developmental, pervasive
exactly.
developmental
right.
issues. So, again, there's a reason for that, too. So was the person really properly diagnosed as, I don't know, category A in autism, or was it really category B and the symptoms really haven't changed? They were just misdiagnosed. So it's a very, very complicated situation.
And Dr. Whaley, right now, there are two medications approved for use in autism
this
spectrum?
This is something to cry about. We really only have two medications that are approved for use in Asperger's disorder. And it's not – the medicines don't target the core symptoms – the core symptoms being social communication and repetitive behavior. They just target the irritability that sometimes can come up. The two medicines are known generally. Abilify, people see that advertised on TV for adding on to depression. Mm-hmm. But it's used here to help with the irritability of the condition. And the other one is Risperdal. It's another one of the major tranquilizers that's been in use for 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is just touch the aim at the irritability. Now, when I say that, that doesn't mean that those are the only drugs that are prescribed for kids with autism, because when a autistic child or adult comes in for treatment, we start with a chief complaint and what is the main problem. And if there is some symptom that can be targeted by medication that is similar to other conditions, we'll use it and try it, because it's all trial and error. And that's how we get our results, is mm-hmm. trial and error. But in terms of what the FDA actually approves, there's only two, and it's for just the irritability that can occur.
But they're looking at three others that could be approved somewhere down the line?
They're looking at many others, mm-hmm. But there are three that have at least risen to or at least been developed to get close to approval. One of them is called, this is an interesting story, called Arbaclofen, which is a version of a commonly used medication used for muscle spasticity back problems mm-hmm. called Baclofen. It's a similar chemical. This has been tested, and it has not proven to be good enough to separate from placebo, is the mm-hmm. language, to be good enough to be used. However, this illustrates a point that that I think Mike just made, is how difficult it is to assess mm-hmm. the effectiveness, because there's no good scale that's used for assessing change in this condition. And what scales that are used rely on parental and caregiver input, which can be very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
So in that scenario, a benefit to a medication may be hidden.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, with this drug, the company withdrew its funds to further develop it because it flunked, at mm-hmm. least initially, even though patients who were in part of the study clamored for continuing to get the medicine, mm. which they could no longer do, because they saw some benefit. So that's one. Another one, there's a hormone that we know promotes social connectiveness and communication and bonding, and that's oxytocin. It's a normal hormone that we all – that females primarily have, but males have too. That has a lot to do with delivery. It's the Pitocin that's given to right after delivery to shut down the uterus and stop the bleeding. That's oxytocin. And it's used to help or its function is to help with milk production. So it's one of our reliable hormones, if you will. It promotes social connectiveness. So there have been studies which have been shown to be somewhat positive, but again, not enough to get FDA approval. Introducing it intranasally in a spray. Mm-hmm. And the interesting, well, again, the problem here in our society, our the way we do things, is oxytocin is not going to be able to be patented. So there's no drug company that's going to invest a lot of money to get it approved. So this has to be done more or less voluntarily by charity, actually, to get it developed.
So, aside from drugs, how else are we treating autism? What are some of the treatment options?
Well, again, you have to differentiate which type of autism we're talking about, and many times for people who have the less observable autistic issues, they run into the problem that kids often have when they're in school. They go to the school nurse, they say they're sick, and you know, the nurse looks at them and has to make an evaluation because there's no bone sticking out. Mm-hmm. So I guess they're maybe not sick, or maybe they are. So if people don't have an observable behavior, like flapping behavior or irritability or a very observable, dramatic kind of stuff that becomes a chief complaint that people say, wow, this person needs something done, they really can suffer. They really do have a lot of psychological suffering because at some level, their sense of connectedness to other people is so diminished. And people who have certain types of autism, what we call so-called higher-functioning autism, are extremely bright. They're rocket scientists. Mm-hmm. And it's to their strength that they try and cognitively mediate some of their symptomatology and try and figure out what's going on. But sometimes you just can't think your way out of an emotion, so emotions can really throw them for a loop. So I said all that so I could say this. So as a prelude to the kind of treatment for people who have a higher level of autism, cognitive behavioral therapy can work if it involves all the three levels of interaction that humans have for understanding other humans, which is emotional, cognitive, and physiological. And it takes several months just to get a baseline on board with people who feel comfortable with that. So there is some treatment available. It is rather arduous, and it really depends on developing trust with the individual, because no matter what you're talking about in therapy, there could be underlying currents that they're not going to mention to you because they're so puzzled by it, or else they're so worried by it and they feel overwhelmed by it. And it takes a while for those things to rise to the surface, so they'll mention those two as well.
Or they can't even find the words for it.
Or they can't find the words for it, right. Yeah.
Susan Senator has written a couple of books on this topic. She's a mom of three boys. One of her boys, her oldest boy, I believe, has autism, I think pretty severe. In her book, The Autism Mom Survival Guide, she writes, "The science of autism has not kept pace with the increasing diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. The number of therapies that abound without clear guidelines or recommendations from the medical establishment contribute in large part to the autism blame game and to unhappy parents, and finally the resources that we all compete for." Very frustrating.
Well, it's worse than frustrating. It's worse than frustrating. I once had people I worked with who insisted that I contact certain organizations because they apparently had more information about autism than a licensed psychologist would have. And I tried to point out to them that there's so much variability in the training that they may have had good luck with information from someone who is a psychologist or a social worker or a licensed mental health counselor, but that the level of training, we have so many different kinds of appellations on people now with so many different kinds of so-called credentials, it's really hard to find out who has got the level of training that are able to help people. So if you go to someone who is a counselor, I don't even know what that means anymore. Right. Are they a licensed counselor? Are they a Christian counselor? Are they a licensed mental health counselor? Are they a marriage and family therapist? All these people can do therapy, but they don't have the same level of education and experience. Now, it doesn't matter what kind of credentials you have. You could develop a huge amount of education and experience after years in the field, and you could become an expert with a master's degree or any kind of credentialing. You don't need to have a PhD or a PsyD or an MD to be able to really do good therapy. But most my experience on the Cape is we don't have a lot of highly qualified people at the lesser degree level who work in the community centers, and that's where most of the people get their therapy. So there's so much variability, it's really hard to be able to answer that question with any kind of equanimity. Have you found the same thing?
Yes, I would say so. Plus, there's a new discipline, ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis.
Yeah.
And these are people that specialize in trying to use behavioral therapy to treat probably a little bit more of the more impaired autistic kids that are in school. They have some evidence that their interventions help.
Well, ABA really does help, but there are severe limitations to ABA. I was trained in ABA before we called it ABA because when I went through graduate school as trained as a behavioral clinician, we learned all about that kind of stuff, and that was pretty much all that there was. It was stimulus response, stimulus other response, and it can be helpful, but it has severe limitations, and most of the people who are trained in ABA cannot generalize. The research does not generalize from where it was originated, which is in very tightly controlled scientific or hospital structures, to the wider environment, such as the world, where you have very little control of the variables. Has some success for a small range of behaviors in enclosed classrooms. But what really has to be done is develop that into a more useful, practical, hands-on experience, because a simple ABA is something like the old token reward system that parents used to use for kids. It only works in a closed system. Once you open up the system, the old star system and star charts and that kind of reward system is very limited.
Right. We're talking about autism. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. So this sort of goes back to this, you know, how complicated, how individual it all is. And so as a parent and you're trying to figure out what is the best treatment for your child, it goes back to what you said, Mark, earlier about trial and error with the medication. It's trial and error. If you have a treatment that's working,
stay with it.
Yeah, right?
Well, you should stay with it and also try and stretch it a bit. But I want to go back to the ABA that Dr. Whaley mentioned. Now there's a lot of coverage. There's some legislation that had to be passed because the insurance company wouldn't do it on their own. Now they will cover ABA services. Yeah. So people should try. If you never had coverage for autistic, specifically an autistic diagnosis before, now you probably will by mandated by law. So check that out again. And specifically ABA people, that's not a bad place to start. If you have limitations in the ABA treatment because the therapist doesn't know much more than that, you can always augment that by outside therapy and outside therapists. So you can really put a package together and design your own program with a case manager. You can do that on your own. That may be the best way to go for some people.
Also, just to interrupt, I would think it might make sense to get a good, thorough evaluation at a place in Boston, like a children's hospital or something like that, and at least do at least some baseline testing and recommendations from at least what those experts have to say.
Well, let me capitalize on what Dr. Whaley just mentioned. Getting some baseline testing is extremely important in terms of higher functioning autistic people who have a nonverbal learning disability. We spoke about this a little bit before. Many people in school will let a nonverbal learning disability slide by. And nonverbal learning disability is much more debilitating to a person's sense of self and their psychological development than a verbal learning disability. If you can't read, people can... Well, I shouldn't say this. I was going to say people can pick it up pretty easily, but I know cases where they haven't. Mm-hmm. But it's more observable. And observable behavior tends to get grabbed onto first in terms of evaluated for an IEP, individual education plan under Chapter 766. But the nonverbal learning disabilities tend to skate by. So a good, strong neuropsychological workup, even though it's not going to diagnose Asperger's or autistic spectrum necessarily, it will pick up nonverbal learning disability. And if you have a nonverbal learning disability, that must be remediated. Now, having an NVLD doesn't mean you have an autistic spectrum disorder, but all the research has always indicated if you have any kind of autistic spectrum disorder, you do have an NVLD.
Could you explain what a nonverbal learning disorder is exactly?
Good question. Nonverbal learning disability is kind of a misnomer. It really should have been called not a verbal learning disability. So we talk about learning disabilities. In the old days, I have trouble reading, I have trouble writing, I have trouble communicating, I stutter, I have dyslexia, I reverse letters, I can't do my math, I can't do my spelling, all that kind of stuff. Well, now we know that's called dyscalculia if you can't do your math. It's called dyslexia if you can't read, but also there are other kinds of reading disorders as well. And we've gotten pretty good at diagnosing a lot of those. Now, most people think that that's all learning disabilities that we have. But in actuality, only about 7% of human communication is verbal. So verbal is narrowly defined to be reading, writing, and arithmetic kind of stuff. 93% is nonverbal. It's not verbal skills at all. It's how you can relate to another person. I look at your face. Are you happy? Are you sad? Mm-hmm. I hear your voice. Are you trying to give me a warning or not? It's like being, I don't know, if I went into the forest, if I went into the jungle and I would hear animal sounds. What do these animal sounds mean? Are they friendly sounds? Are they not sounds? So a nonverbal learning disability simply means it's the interpersonal skills that have to do with spatial relations, and spatial relations is intimately intertwined with interpersonal relations, human relationships, not verbal human communication skills. So it's like an iceberg. Individual education plans for verbal learning disabilities are the tip of the iceberg that you can see. The nonverbal learning disabilities, or the not verbal, or the other than verbal learning disabilities, are all that spaces, all that part of the iceberg under the water that mm-hmm. you can't see. And that is where the big danger lies, and right. that is where the developmental issues really lie. So it really should be diagnosed. So even if there's not a test for Asperger's or autism, there is a test for nonverbal learning disabilities, and even if you stumble into it by accident, it's worthwhile having your kid tested, no question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
I know there's probably a lot of folks in the audience who are familiar with Temple Grandin, and she really, she's done many interviews, I know, in Diane Rehm and other programs. She has really been very helpful in understanding what it's like to be autistic. I'm sure you both are familiar with her.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and how she thinks. And I mean, it's wonderful to be able to you know, have some of that information.
Sure.
Because for a lot of, you know, people with, especially the severely autistic, they're not able to communicate what's going on.
Right.
Well, that's true. And I guess it's true in a lot of conditions. If you've never experienced a kind of depression or anxiety or a panic attack, then it's really hard for you to understand. And I've had people say, well, why is so-and-so depressed? Why don't they just you know, right. get out of bed and get to work? Well, obviously you don't get depression. If they could, believe me, they would. No one wishes this on themselves. So any kind of musical accompaniment that they can give to the words in music, it helps us understand. That's really important, that any kind of information to help the people who don't have an experience of autism mm-hmm. to understand what it's like, because it is so foreign and it's so frustrating right. for the people who have it. They are so trapped.
Right. And so right. frustrating for the families as well.
Especially.
But
somebody like Temple Grandin is a gem, really, because she can describe.
Right.
She can communicate.
Right. She speaks for them.
She speaks well without, even though it's a disorder of communication.
Yeah.
She has enough communication skills to get it across.
But typically it's a disorder of nonverbal communication. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have a lot of kids, I referred to them before, when if they're higher functioning, they can be a rocket scientist. They can do great at school.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if our kids do great at school, we think, there's no problem.
Right.
But we don't realize that the majority of school learning happens in the social area. It's got right. nothing to do with the verbal stuff. So they can be very verbally communicative, and they can be so lost at sea in the nonverbal
right.
kind
and
of stuff.
And very lonely. I mean,
extremely lonely.
I mean, these children finding friends is right. very difficult.
That's right. Yeah, don't conclude that because the kids might like to be alone, and it's less mm-hmm. stressful for them to be alone, that they don't have longings for right. friendships and right. connection.
You're listening to The Point. We're discussing autism with psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Well, we were talking about the frustration, not only for the person with autism, but the family. And one of the things that I think is incredibly frustrating is there seem to be more resources when your child is school age. And then once they become adults, young adults, looking, you know, for resources gets a whole lot harder.
And one of the advantages, and I think probably for the proliferation of diagnosis, going back about a dozen years, there was more money put into autism, because previously there was not very much money put into this relatively unknown and weird kind of condition called autism. And as more money poured into resources, more people got the diagnosis of autism. And then, of course, the diagnosis of autism began to get stretched, because some of these people didn't seem autistic at all, and then you had Asperger's, then you had pervasive developmental disorder. So it's really been the kind of genesis that's been developed because of the resources that poured into that. And many years before that, there was more money poured into, at least in Massachusetts, in money into the Department of Mental Retardation, where people got the diagnosis of retardation, than a psychiatric or psychological diagnosis, a mental health diagnosis, because there were more funds available. And schools, as you rightly say, they've got all the money in terms of helping these kids get back on track. And after they finish their transition, if they're lucky enough to get an IEP, at least in Massachusetts, that ends around 22 years old. And where do you go after that? You pretty much are in free fall.
Exactly.
That's right. There's no money. They follow the money, and it stops then.
Yeah. And when we look at, we mentioned the numbers earlier on, we're looking at the numbers and this rising, diagnosis all the time. We have a big challenge on our hands going forward, especially for some of these young adults who are severely autistic. And, you know, you've got parents saying, what's going to happen when I die? Well, you know, who's going to take care of my
exactly.
child?
Exactly.
Yeah,
right, that's true. We have the same kind of condition, the same kind of situation developing with people who have attention deficit disorder and any other kind of condition that attracts attention in childhood. There are really no resources out there. We know better about some of the conditions like ADHD and depression, anxiety, panic. We can hit home runs with those in therapy now, but autism is such a slippery kind of diagnosis. There are so many different kinds of subconditions of autism. It's hard to be able to classify them and say we are hitting home runs with all of them, too.
Right. Let's talk to Elaine, who's giving us a call from Dennisport. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning. Thank you for your topic and taking my call.
Sure.
So everything the doctors have talked about, I feel like I've lived through. Mm-hmm. My child is 9 and a half, and he's in the Cape Cod school system, and he's been on an IEP since kindergarten, which is typically pretty early. But he was in early intervention from early life, and his diagnosis through two neuropsychological tests at 5 and at 8 showed ADHD, nonverbal learning disorder, anxiety, potentially PTSD. And I think I'm missing one. But all along, I had been asking, does he not appear, it presents like Asperger's. And I think in the end, you need something like that in order to get your IEP. And then once you get that and you get your child the services necessary, it's hugely incumbent upon the parent to stay on top of it. And I know that a lot of folks just don't have the wherewithal, the time, the energy, the knowledge to really push. And I think you were just talking about that while I was waiting, about the school. I mean, my child is now getting ready to go into fourth grade and isn't even remotely close. Mm. So there's a two-part issue that I'm finding. One, the education system pushes them along even though they may not be ready. Mm-hmm. But then the social aspect gets worse and worse as the children get older, and it makes it harder for these little kids who don't know what they don't know and don't know what they're missing to maneuver through the system.
Well, what you say is entirely true, and it depends on the variability of the school systems. We have some really good school systems here on Cape Cod that work very hard for kids who have any kind of autistic-ish kind of condition. Some school systems don't even really require a huge workup before they can classify someone. And other school systems, regrettably, you've got to drag them kicking and screaming before a mediation board before they'll give you any services. So there's a lot of variability. But my recommendation is that if social skills are really a condition of treatment, that you think the social skills or social nuances or the nonverbal part need to be treatment, it's better to put a child in individual therapy. Because my own experience as a clinician, for years I've been trying to get social skills group going, and I've had clinicians refer their patients for the social skills group. There just does not seem to be enough of parental involvement in getting their kids to social skills group. I couldn't even get 4 or 5 kids together for one group because there are so many other activities that kids were doing. So there certainly is a need for social skills development groups, but there does not seem to be any will to have it developed on the Cape. And outside of the Cape, I think there are some areas.
Sorry to interrupt. I think I found the opposite, though. My son has been in therapy with a specialist for many years. And within that practice, there is another individual who has been trying to put together one of these. And we have at least 5 parents. Hmm. We can't find a location. Hmm. Actually, house it. That would be accepting of the children. I don't know if it's...
You know, Elaine, let's have Jenny take your phone number, and we'll give you a call after the show and talk a little bit more about that. So Jenny's going to grab your number, Elaine. Thanks for calling. And she brings up a really good point. Again, back to that frustration as a parent, and your child is socially isolated, it's heartbreaking. And, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, you have to advocate. Yeah. It's just difficult, but it actually might be good practice to advocate for your child, because the way medicine is turning out these days, you have to advocate for yourself every day.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I think Dr. Will has hit on something important. I want to say that we, although we're focusing on autism today and all the difficulties, we have a myriad of difficulties. Mm-hmm. If you're an adult caregiver of someone who has Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. the same thing. Situation. Mm-hmm. Yep. If you're a caregiver at all for any kind of right. condition, if your child has chronic asthma, yep. it's the same kind same of condition. Thing, yep. So there is much more of a unanimity and a commonality for parents and families with autistic kids as with any other condition. All these conditions are the same. Everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to become your own expert.
Right.
And don't be afraid of advocating for yourself to the point of bringing in written material suggesting that your clinician look up more information, because the clinicians are overloaded no matter what profession you're in, and they're doing the best they can. And you have to advocate for yourself.
Right. Susan is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm new to Falmouth. I'm a speech-language pathologist. I've been working with autistic children for a number of years. And just had a couple of comments, a couple of things I'd like to share
sure.
from my perspective. I couldn't agree more that social skills groups are imperative, particularly as children get into elementary school. I also wanted to say that diagnosing kids, I've worked with kids at a year and a half, 2 years, and I found ABA to be imperative. And what I've done is worked with the ABA specialists who go into the home, and they work with the children like 6 hours a day with these kids who have been diagnosed and are really socially not connected and not verbal. And having the ABA and then having the speech pathologist work together with ABA seems to be a very good plan of action.
How do they connect with these kids?
Pardon me?
How do they connect with these kids?
Well, the ABA is doing the almost like a conditioning, and you know, having the child sitting in a seat and rewarding them for the slightest amount of eye contact or whatever, and then the speech pathologist is doing that. Is there also, and then working on the verbal aspect as much as possible, working, reinforcing the eye contact, and maybe seeing the child, is going into ABA, observing what they're doing, and then the parents come and to speech therapy, private speech therapy with their child, and then that is, then there's more language-based, you know, and as the child gets older, and the child needs, for example, these children often don't generalize at all, so they show them a picture of a dog, of a collie, and then they say dog, and they've got that word, and then you show them a picture of a poodle, and they have no idea. So mm-hmm. generalizing that these are all dogs, that kind of thing, that's language, internal language. That's just a very simple example.
Right.
Also, I found working with parents, I was working west of Boston before I moved here, and that it's very difficult. I couldn't concur more that you need a diagnosis, someone a neuropsychologist to really do a lot of testing and figure out exactly what are the parameters of this thing that's going on mm-hmm. with their child.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the thing is that if you try to make an appointment with a neuropsychologist, say at Children's Hospital, it's often a 6-month wait.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, the child is, you know, pretty much further into the behaviors. And I'd really be interested in knowing, you know, what resources there are in the Cape for parents for evaluations.
Right.
Let me jump in a little bit on that, and I'll have to come out and regrettably say at this point, I really don't refer people to Children's anymore, because I found the variability in their reports varies with the amount of the type of interns or graduate students they have, and so I don't do that anymore. And there's a lot of problems with the long wait. We have had plenty of people on Cape Cod and the South Shore and in Boston in private practice who can do terrific neuropsychological reports. You don't need to go to Children's except if your insurance does not, mm-hmm. they don't accept your insurance now. So that is a problem. But if you have, for example, say MassHealth, which is a great insurance if you have it. However, they don't pay a lot of money for any kind of psychological testing or neuropsychological testing. So you're probably not going to find a lot of individual private practitioners who do take MassHealth who would be able to afford to do the kind of neuropsychological test that you would need for a child based on just reimbursement and outpatient private practice. So for that reason, you probably have to go to a hospital like Children's. But I would recommend also contacting any major hospital. Mass General Hospital has got many satellite clinics Children's Hospital has other satellite clinics, not just the one in Boston. You can go to any of the South Shore hospitals. Pretty much any psychiatry department has psychologists and neuropsychologists on staff. So I would probably suggest taking your insurance to any other hospital and seeing what they have there, first of all.
Including Cape Cod Hospital.
Including Cape Cod Hospital, exactly. Yeah. So I would start with Cape Cod and Jordan's Hospital. Then you work your way down before you finally have to go. Because it's a long wait, and I've had patients have gone into Children's, and it's been sometimes a horrible drive, and which is good for a neuropsychologist because I get to see the child when they're absolutely over the edge. I get to see the worst they have, and that's great for the diagnostic workup. It's not great for the parents or the child, however. And then after having 5 or 6 hours of neuropsych testing, then they have to take 2 or 3 hours to come back out if the traffic's bad.
Yeah.
So locally, there are a lot more resources here in private practitioners, and you have to try and ferret them out.
Yeah. Susan, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. There's a couple of things with it. A lot of people, when they think of severe autism, the movie Rain Man and that, that's the savant like abilities, in math or, trivia. It's really sort of an what's happening in the brain there. Do we know that you can have these savant abilities in one area and then, this total lack of social communication skills in the other?
Well, it could just be that because they don't process social information, they have a lot of brain power to do other things. That might be the explanation. I don't know.
We don't know, right?
We really don't know.
Yeah, we're really kind of clueless about that. But certainly if people have very good cognitive skills. That's their strength. They could tend to play to their strength. And the more you use anything, the better it gets.
So, sure. It's like somebody who is blind. They can hear better.
What about violence?
Yeah.
Well, I'm against it personally.
Yeah, I don't want it either.
Too broad a question.
This is something that's in our face with the school shooting from last December. Adam Lanza probably has been suspected of having some kind of autism. And we haven't really heard much about him in terms of details of his development, et cetera. But given that as it may, we should not just conclude that autistic means violence. There is a little bit of higher violent tendencies if an autistic person is also intellectually impaired. There are statistics that support that. And autistic kids do have, or autistic people do have, are subject to more tantrums.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they're violently directed toward harming somebody or harming somebody else, really because they're not connected or it's not meaningful for them.
Right.
So autism and violence is something that doesn't deserve a whole lot of headlines.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really true. People think that if you can label someone, oh, this person is such and such, that must mean therefore they're such and such. They paint with such a broad brush. Well, a person can be autistic. And they can have violent tendencies, which have nothing to do with the autism whatsoever.
Right.
A person can be depressed and have violent tendencies, but has nothing to do with the fact that they have a learning disability. Or it might have something to do. So you can't paint with such a broad brush. And it's just because someone has a diagnostic condition, any more than someone has cardiovascular problems. Mm-hmm. If someone's going to die in 6 months and they have a cancer issues, are they more violent because they've got nothing left to lose than someone who has autism? You really can't determine that.
I mentioned Susan Senator earlier, her first book, Making Peace with Autism. I thought she had some great tips in there, how she dealt with certain issues with her son. And one of them was, he would have difficulty when they'd go to the, her parents or it was her the child's grandparents for a holiday. She made a picture book, we're going to get in the car. And that seemed to help him because he knew where they were at in the day. They could look in his picture book. And I just want to mention that Susan Senator is one of four authors who are going to be at this Autism and Authors conference at the Craigville Retreat Center on Monday, August 12th. And we'll put a link up to Cape Cod Village's website on our website, capeandislands.org, if you want more information on that.
The more connectedness parents could have with other parents and professionals who know about autism, the more they can be connected with them, the better.
Yeah, yes.
Absolutely. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Willey, as always, thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.